So today we'll be continuing our study of the discourse on the arousing of mindfulness, or the foundations of mindfulness. And we're quite a ways into the sutta. Hopefully we'll be able to finish it up today. We're talking about the five aggregates of clinging. So I don't know if you can find that in the sutta down near the bottom. If you look up aggregates or clinging, you'll probably find it. If you were here last week, you should know where we are. If not, just find it at the five aggregates of clinging. Yeah, you better tell him to turn on his voice. So the five aggregates of clinging are considered to be the basis of reality, or the basis of existence. That this is how clinging arises, and sort of how life promulgates, why we're born again and again, and sort of how our life continues on. These are often just understood as the five aggregates of a being, but the adjective here of clinging, or the qualifier, is that these are really what we're clinging to, these five things in our life. We sometimes cling to physical form, we sometimes cling to feelings, we sometimes cling to memories, we sometimes cling to thoughts or judgments or views, and we sometimes cling to consciousness. And in general, we cling to them all together. Sometimes we can cling to all five at once. And we cling generally because we don't understand them for what they are. We don't see form for what it is, physical form, just as being a physical form. These five things work together to allow us, or to lead us away from experiential reality into concept and convention and inevitably clinging. And because they lead to clinging, then they lead to addiction, and then lead to suffering. So in the practice of mindfulness, it's a little bit of an advanced teaching, but it's something that's important for us to understand about the clinging to these five things. So it says in the sutta, we understand what is material form, we understand the arising and the disappearance of material form. And so we don't cling to them as a result. When there's form arises, for instance, when we're walking and we feel the movements of our feet, we come to see what is real about the physical form. I mean, normally we look at a physical form and we're right away judging about it. That's beautiful, or that's ugly. Maybe that's me, or that's mine, and if it's not perfect, then we get upset because our form is not perfect, or it's not the way we would like it, not the way we want it to be. And the same with feelings. When we have feelings, then right away we feel happy about good feelings, and we like them, and then we cling to them. And we're always craving after pleasant feelings, pleasant sensations, pleasant experiences. We come to cling to the feeling, or else we cling to unpleasant feelings as bad, as evil, as undesirable. So we have these states of depression that can drive us crazy, drive us to commit suicide, and so on. Drive us to take medication, to see a therapist or a counselor, or so on. Simply because we don't understand and we can't come to accept and to understand these things, to see them for what they are. Memories as well. I've talked about these things before, but memories can be very can be very enticing as well, as far as giving rise to clinging to past memories as the good old days, or the way things used to be, or when I was young, or so on. Experiences that we had which we remember as being totally pleasant and desirable. And in reality it's probably not the case, but even if it were the case that it was a pleasant, perfectly pleasant experience, it doesn't do us much good to remember about it, or to think about it, or to wish for it again, except to give rise to more and more clinging and craving and displeasure when we don't get similar experiences. And of course the opposite is equally true, if not more so, that unpleasant memories, bad things that have happened to us, that other people have done to us, can devastate us. People who were abused as children, who went through abusive relationships, or have had bad things come to them, when just by remembering about these experiences, they can keep themselves trapped in a cycle of horror, of hell, long after the experience has passed, and it's perpetual, even though the experience is long over. One still keeps oneself in a state of perpetual torture, self-torture. And the same goes with the fourth aggregate, is our thoughts and our judgments. This is probably the single most devastating or most dangerous of the five aggregates. The five parts of who we are is our judgments, because really the rest don't have any power over us until we make some judgment call about them. We say, this is a good one, this is a bad one, this one is me, this one is mine, and so on. And so by judging things and by compartmentalizing reality into good and bad, into us and them, and into high and low, and so on, right and wrong, we give rise to all sorts of suffering. And consciousness as well is something that we cling to. But altogether we cling to these five because we don't understand them for what they are. And so the key here is to be able to separate them into their various categories. Simply knowing that this is what constitutes experience, these five things, is enough to allow a person to meditate on any one of these. So sometimes we can meditate on form, watching our stomach rise and fall, or watching our feet move when we walk. Sometimes we can focus on feeling, just watching the painful feelings or happy feelings, saying to ourselves, pain, pain, or happy, happy. If we feel calm, saying calm, calm. Just reminding ourselves about the reality of it. And we break apart this whole process of clinging, which goes in sequence until we're judging and then acting out on our judgments. When we see that these things are coming and going, they're arising and ceasing. When we do this in meditation, then there's no clinging arises. There's nothing inside or outside that we cling to. And this is all that is really important for us to do. People can say what they like about this or that is the right way, or that is the right way. But really it's more than enough to be able to give up clinging, our clinging and our craving for things which are right in front of us. We don't need all of these special magical experiences. I have people asking me how they can fly through the air, how they can open their third eye. And my response is invariably, if you want to fly, take a plane. And what's wrong with the two eyes that you have that you need a third eye? There's lots of fun experiences that we can have in meditation. Some people want to see wonderful things, which they would be able to see just as easily on the computer or on a television if they were to bother. And they think that seeing these things is somehow special. But when you start to practice based on this sutta, based on the four foundations of mindfulness, especially the five aggregates here, you come to see that really this is all that is necessary for us to become free from suffering, to be truly happy, is to simply let go, to see things for what they are. So the five aggregates is quite useful. quite useful. It's one way of looking at the core of the Buddha's teaching, that the Buddha was able to split up experience into these five things is considered to be due to his profound wisdom, his ability to split experience up into its pieces, that we could thus contemplate it and get rid of the illusion of being, of self, of me, of mine, of things which could then be desirable or undesirable. Because there's nothing particularly desirable about any of these once you break them up into their individual part. Then we have this stock phrase, thus he lives contemplating mental objects. And again, mental objects is not quite what I would use to translate Dhamma here. I would translate, he contemplates realities, or he contemplates the teachings of the Buddha, and clings to naught in the world. And this is the key for the whole of the sutta, is that when we do this, we don't cling. It's like, mindfulness is kind of like a solvent. If you think of it like our ordinary state of experience is sticky, it's got glue, and it's like pouring water all over a sticky substance, and it dissolves. If your hands have sugar all over them, or sticky from candy or from sweets, and then when you pour water all over it, it just dissolves. Mindfulness is, the feeling is exactly like that, that it just dissolves. The clinging, the craving, the wanting, the needing, the dislike and displeasure and so on, it all just disappears. So this is one very important way of looking at reality. The other way of looking at reality is from the point of view of where it occurs, and this is the next section. The next section is the six internal and six external sense bases. So how it works is this. Well, the six senses are the five senses that we know and understand in the West, the eye, the ear, the seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling. And then we just add the sixth one is thinking. So thinking is considered to be a sense, because obviously it has nothing to do with the other five, but obviously there's some experience occurring there. It's just that in the West we don't really realize this or include it in as an experience. And the six internal and external simply means the part that receives and the part that transmits. So the receivers are the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, the body, and the mind. The transmitter, or the stimuli, are the sights and sounds and smells and tastes and feelings and thoughts, which arise at the six sense doors. And so how it works is this. At the eye, you're going to have the five aggregates arise. You're going to have, first you're going to have the eye, and then you're going to have the form, in this case means light, which touches the eye. And then you have the five aggregates of clinging arise. So you have this process of clinging occur at the eye, and so this is what it's talking about. The arising of non-arisen fetters comes to be, and the abandoning of arisen fetters comes to be. So at the eye, when you see, then there's the form, there's the five aggregates, there's the physical, which is the eye and the light. Then there's the feeling, you feel happy about it or unhappy about it. Then there's the memories, you see something and you remember that person as being a friend or an enemy. And then there's the thoughts. Well, what do you think about them? You like them, you don't like them, you judge and you process the information. And then there's the consciousness. The consciousness is the awareness that allows it to all happen. So these five aggregates are all present at the eye at the moment of seeing. At the moment when you see, all five of these aggregates are there. And same at the moment of hearing, at the moment of smelling, at the moment of tasting, at the moment of feeling, and possibly at the moment of thinking, although at the moment of thinking it's generally accepted in many cases at least there is no physical, although I'm not sure exactly how that works. As I understand it, there is the physical as being the brain and the physical base of the mind, But the actual experience is a purely mental one. When we think, for instance, then there's no physical stimulus. And talking about the fetters here, in Buddhism there are considered to be 10 fetters. So what arises, this sort of clinging or the various types of clinging that arise, is broken up into 10 parts. The tenfold fetters are, fetter is sense desire. So this is the sort of the obvious one that we're talking about, when you like something or you don't like something. Or this is, sorry, specifically when you like something. Resentment, when you don't like something, when you see or hear or smell or taste or feel or think. Pride. Pride when you think that of how great you are and how great is your awareness and your experience. Thinking that you're better than other people or so on. Views. Views when you take whatever you see as being permanent or so on, when you take it to be a self, I see, this is me seeing, or this is my experience. When you come to give rise to the idea of a self or a soul, when you believe that you're controlling things, when you speak, then it's I who speaks, and so on. When you act, then it's I who acts. Then the fetter of doubt is one who is not sure. Sees something and is not sure how to react, or is not sure what is right, is not sure whether to chase after it or not chase after it, is not sure whether it's good or bad, and so on. And all of these are bad because they're leading the mind to become stuck. They're stopping the mind from seeing clearly. And when you can't see clearly, then there gives rise to craving and clinging. There's room for suffering. It's kind of like being out of harmony with reality. Keeps one stuck. Keeps one not progressing or not. It's like still sticky. There's the desire to go on existing and the desire to. The desire to go on existing. To be born again and so on, to want to be this and want to be that when you see and hear. I mean, it's all that's being said here is everything that we experience in our lives, our desires to be this or to be that, all comes from the six senses. Suddenly there arises a thought, you know, think of something, and then suddenly you say, yeah, I want to be that, or so on. But it all comes from some sort of phenomenon arising at one of the six senses. You see someone else getting this or getting that, and you want to attain it as well. You want to be big, and you want to be this, or just wanting to be born again, wanting to come back again, but basically wanting to be anything, a sort of attachment to being. And then there's the fetter of rites and ceremonies, rites and rituals. Rites and rituals means the fetter of doing things with that have no causal relationship with the fruit that one expects from them. So maybe giving offerings to a god that one has never seen, or maybe just doing all sorts of rituals like burning incense or lighting candles or chanting mantras or this or that with no idea in your mind of how the causal relationship works. All of these things can be useful if in your mind there is something good going on, but simply believing that as a ritual something special is going to happen, like people who burn incense thinking that it's going to keep demons away, or burn incense thinking that their ancestors are going to be happy because of it, or so on. This is sort of a wrong idea. People who get into wrong practices like torturing themselves or killing animals as sacrifice and so on. All because of a misunderstanding of experience. So sometimes, you know how they say how religion arose? It arose based on misunderstanding things like rain and things like drought. And, you know, it can sometimes be coincidental where you do something and suddenly it rains, or you do something and suddenly a sickness goes away or so on, and because of the coincidence, I mean, when it doesn't go right, you don't think of it, you don't remember it. But we always remember when something happens coincidentally. And so as a result, we trick ourselves in this way. We forget about all the hundreds of times it didn't work. And every time it does work, we start to think, oh, then maybe there's something to this. And we give rise to superstition. And this is where rites and rituals, you know, knocking on wood, all sorts of rituals for the harvest and so on, which, you know, because once in a while they happen to work, there happens to be a coincidental occurrence. This is the idea of rites and rituals, and it's based on misunderstanding experience and making more of it than it is. And also a desire for certain results, which of course is a type of clinging. And the fetter of envy, and the fetter of jealousy or stinginess. So envy is desire for things that others have, and stinginess is the desire that others may not have the things that one has. And these come, of course, from craving and from clinging. When you see something and you know it belongs to someone else, and so you start to develop this state of plotting to try to get it away from that person, try to obtain what they have. And stinginess as well, when you have something and you like it, it automatically arises because we like it and we want it, and it's very difficult for us to have to part with it. If someone else comes, there first arises this knowledge that they want it, and sort of a processing of the idea that one should share with them or give to them. But then because of the greed, it covers this over, and there arises stinginess, which covers that up and blocks it out and stops us from sharing. And so this arises at the eye, at the ear, at the nose, at the tongue, at the body, and the heart. And without we don't normally realize this. It shouldn't sound familiar. What should be familiar is all of these fetters arise based on our interactions with people, places, and things. But the point here is that if we were to see it as simply seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking, then the fetters would not arise. When we see someone and then it's all about our attachment to them and our likes and dislikes of the way they act and behave, it's all based on things which don't really exist. Because all that exists really is the seeing, the hearing, the smelling, the tasting, the feeling, and most importantly, the thinking. And once we can see this, then the arisen fetters will cease. So I think these two are pretty self-explanatory. They're pretty basic, and they're a basic meditation technique. And we often have meditators, when they see things, to just have them remind themselves of that it's just seeing. And so they say to themselves, seeing, seeing, seeing. When they hear things, they say hearing, hearing, not listening or trying to process it and make more out of it than it actually is, because all that it really is a sound. And this, of course, is only for people who are doing an intensive meditation course. Of course, there are times in your daily life where you want to hear and you want to listen. But there can also be times where it's not appropriate to listen and not appropriate to get involved either, when someone's yelling at you or so on. It's often best just to say to yourself, hearing, hearing. And you do actually understand in a general sense what they're saying. It's not as though it's going to stop you from reacting positively. In fact, if you're able to do this, if you're able to just listen and say to yourself, hearing, hearing, you find that you're able to understand the gist of what's being said much better and have the right response after the person has finished speaking. Smelling, tasting, feeling. Even when you're eating, we have eating meditation. So when people eat, we have them say to themselves, chewing, chewing, tasting, tasting, swallowing, and so on. And feeling, and of course thinking. Thinking is, of course, the most deadly. It's not that we're trying to stop ourselves from thinking, it's just to be aware that this is going on. You know, this isn't me, and there's no reason to follow after these thoughts. This is just thought, it's just thinking. Because what happens is, right away, this thought arises, and that's me, and that's what I'm going to do, and I'm going to chase after this, or run away from it, or so. Now the next category, the factors of enlightenment, is a little bit more detailed. I'll try not to go into too much detail. I know probably there's many people here who are not going to be familiar with some of these things, and it would be probably useless to go into too much depth. I'll try to keep it fairly basic, but still getting the gist across. I mean, more focusing on meditation than theory, because I think meditation is the most important anyway. So we have seven factors of enlightenment here, and it's talking about the arising and the cessation, which is just driving the point across that everything, all these things arise and cease. But here we're actually trying to develop these seven qualities of mind. We're trying to develop mindfulness, we're trying to develop wisdom, which we call investigation of the Dhammas. We're trying to develop effort, we're trying to develop rapture, we're trying to develop tranquility, we're trying to develop concentration, and we're trying to develop equanimity. But even when these things arise, then we take them as well as our object of meditation, and this actually helps to develop them further, so that when we have effort and then we're aware of our effort, when we have rapture and we're aware of the rapture, we have tranquility and being aware that it does exist or it doesn't exist, and sort of being able to judge our own practice or rate our own practice at what level we are. Are we mindful? Are we not mindful? And there are several things that lead to the arising of these, and I'll just go through them quickly. We're talking about things which are helpful for unarisen mindfulness to arise, and so on. So it says here there are four things which lead to the arising of the enlightenment factor of mindfulness. The first one is mindfulness itself with clear comprehension. So when we focus clearly and completely on an object, when we say to ourselves, rising, falling, watching the stomach, when we use this mantra to fix and to focus on the reality, the second is avoiding of persons with confused minds, people who don't have mindfulness, people who are interested in intoxication and alcohol and drugs and so on. See, nowadays the world is going in that direction. They're actually selling marijuana in stores now, along with alcohol, and so we can see, and not just in terms of material drugs, we're also seeing this sort of immaterial drug as well, like with the computers and music. Nowadays everyone has their iPods and their internet and so on, chasing after wonderful things. People with confused minds, in this way we have to be careful to try to stay with people who are interested in meditation. Like all of us here, we have quite a large group of people interested in developing themselves, trying to stick with people like this, and trying to be careful not to cultivate friends who are only interested in intoxication and inebriation and so on. The third is the association with persons who keep mindfulness ready for application. So people who are always trying and develop and working on being more and more mindful. And the fourth is inclination towards mindfulness. So the desire to be mindful is necessary for it to arise. We have to want to practice. We have to work at it. And so we're always trying to develop this. Mindfulness I've talked a lot about. I think I'll not explain so much what it is. To me it's simply this reminding ourselves of the reality of the situation. It's the most important, but I've gone over it before, so I'll try not to spend too much time here. Once we're mindful and we're aware, as we're reminding ourselves and we remember things for what they are, then there arises this discerning of things as good and bad. This is called investigation of dhammas, or investigation of realities, not mental objects. Investigation of reality. So there are good things and there are bad things, there are right and wrong, bright and dark. And by reflecting on them again and again, we give rise to this wisdom and understanding of what is good and what is bad, what is right and what is wrong. There's a lot of guilt and shame arises in the beginning of meditation because we realize that the untrained mind leads to many shameful things. We realize there is actually a difference between right and wrong, and one way makes us feel sort of dirty and unclean, and when we do certain things it makes us feel pure and happy and at peace with ourselves, confident in who we are. And so this is what is meant by investigation or discernment, being able to tell the difference, being able to categorize things, being able to see the difference between good and bad things, things which are beneficial to ourselves and others and things which are unbeneficial to ourselves and others. This is just another name for wisdom. So mindfulness basically leads to wisdom. And six things lead to the arising of this enlightenment factor. One, inquiring about the aggregates and inquiring about the various objects of meditation. So as we talked about above, being able to see how these things work together and talking about them and asking about them. Number two, the purification of the basis. Basis here is thought to be the cleaning of the body, the clothes and so forth. Sort of like preparing for your meditation or preparing your surroundings, having a clean living space and a clean body and clean clothes, having a undistracted, a place where you can rest undistracted, having a surrounding which is pure, which is natural. And so this is why living in the forest is often useful, because it helps the mind to not become distracted and not become confused. The mind settles down in places of nature and so is able to see clearer. This one is not totally necessary in many ways. It's not always necessary to worry so much about the outside, but it's considered to be helpful to be in a situation or in a atmosphere which is conducive to practice. Number three is imparting evenness to the five spiritual faculties. So I've talked about the faculties before. I think in meditation practice we're trying to balance these. Imparting evenness means to balance them. Again, I'm reading here from the commentary, so don't be confused if you can't find what I'm reading here. I'm reading sort of a commentary on the actual sutta, so don't worry so much about it. You can just listen to me, and we're on the investigation of mental objects in the factors of enlightenment. The five faculties are confidence, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And these exist in everyone, but they exist in different levels, and they're not always balanced. And balancing these is considered to be terribly important in meditation practice. So confidence has to be balanced with wisdom. If we have a lot of confidence but not so much wisdom, then we become like blind faith, and we become gullible. We follow after people who whatever someone tells us to believe, we believe, and we follow after things without considering. And this is why we see people following after ways of practice which are clearly useless or unbeneficial, even because someone told them to do it, and because they didn't use wisdom, then they just followed after it. It also means in meditation we can follow after things when we see or hear them. Sometimes people have visions in meditation, and there's nothing wrong with having visions or hearing things, hearing voices even. The problem arises when you chase after these things. So I've even known people, there was a monk who tried to kill himself because of voices he heard. He tried to kill himself on two different occasions until he finally disrobed, simply because he heard voices. And so there's no power that the voices have over us until we give them the power and somehow become confused and follow after them. And this is because of a lack of wisdom. If a person has strong wisdom and not no faith, then it gets them nowhere as well. So they could understand everything intellectually and have a great understanding of how the five aggregates work together and the six senses and so on. But they still don't believe it when it comes to them. So they've heard it all, but they still don't put the effort out to practice. And so they give rise to all sorts of doubt, and they're not sure about the things that they've learned. They may have learned everything and studied everything, but they're still not sure if it's like this or like that, and maybe they're always wanting to study more and more to somehow get rid of their doubts through studying. And effort and concentration have to balance each other. For a person who has lots of effort but not very much concentration, then they become distracted. Their mind is not focused, and so they can't see clearly as well. If a person has strong concentration but not enough effort, then they become lazy or drowsy and tired and find themselves nodding off in meditation. So we balance these out, as I've said before, with mindfulness. When we practice the four foundations of mindfulness, we don't ever have to worry about that there's going to be too much mindfulness. In fact, the more mindfulness there is, the more better balanced are our faculties. When we have doubt, then we say to ourselves, doubting, doubting. When we feel greedy or wanting or this or that, we just say to ourselves, wanting, wanting. When we feel distracted, so then we focus and we understand the distraction. We see that it's arising and we stop the cycle of it. When we have drowsiness or laziness, actually if you're able to, as I've said before, even laziness or drowsiness or this state of falling asleep, if you're able to catch it in your mind and say to yourself, drowsy, drowsy, and just knowing it for what it is, if you're really good and if you've developed your mind enough, it can just disappear and suddenly you're awake again. You're able to do away with all of these, simply cutting off the cycle and bringing them back to a balanced state. So this is important for the development of wisdom. This is said to be the balancing of the faculties and paying attention to these. Using mindfulness is said to be an important basis for the development of wisdom. The fourth support is avoiding the ignorant, so ignorant people. Avoiding people who think that life is only sleeping, eating, sensual indulgence and so on. People who don't care about spiritual things and so on. Avoiding people who are full of views and beliefs and aren't interested in experiment, empirical observation and so on. Number five is associating with the wise. So these, of course, go together. You should always stay away from ignorant people, people who aren't interested and don't have any understanding about these things and aren't interested in these things. And associating with wise, people who do understand or are interested in understanding and interested in developing themselves and becoming better people and so on. Number six, it looks like there's seven here actually. Number six is reflecting on the profound difference of the hard-to-perceive processes of the aggregates, modes, and so on. Whatever that means. It sounds like there's... I'd have to think about that for a while. I think there's differences in these various things, how the aggregates are different from the senses, how the elements are different as well, and so on, and sort of looking at the intricacies of the Buddha's teaching, which I think could probably get a little bit too intellectual for a meditator, but I suppose it's also useful on a intellectual level, and there is some merit in studying these things. For instance, the five aggregates, four of them are mental and one of them is physical. The six internal sense bases and six external sense bases, 10 of them are physical, one of them is mental, and another one can be either mental or physical. The the elements, almost half of them, let's see, 6 plus 11, let's see, 10 of them, again, are physical, and 9 of them are mental, and 1 of them is either mental or physical, so it's about half and half. So this is, you know, really beyond the scope of what I'm trying to talk about here, but, you know, understanding the difference between these various classifications of teaching. And this is actually would be really useful for a teacher, because there are some people who are very much focused on the physical. And so sometimes the Buddha would teach, give a teaching that was based mostly on the physical, like the 6 senses. The 6 senses is a mostly a physical thing. The only mental part is the mind. Other than that, you've got the eye, the ear, the nose, the tongue, and the body. Some people are very much attached to the mind and on concepts and thoughts, and so he would teach the 5 aggregates. And that's because the feelings, the memories, thoughts, and consciousness, that's mental, and only 1 of them is physical. So for meditators, I'd have to, you know, get a better explanation myself on why this is useful, particularly for meditation. But I suppose it's just giving a complete intellectual backing. And for a meditator, it's probably not so important. And number seven, the inclining towards the development of the investigation of the Dhammas. So inclining towards it. So once we have mindfulness, then we're using it to see things clearly, to understand things, and to give rise to wisdom. So what this means is inclining to actually understand things, hoping to understand things, or looking to understand things, working at understanding. The third one is energy and effort. So once we give rise to wisdom, then we're simply on this path of developing more mindfulness and more wisdom. As we develop more and stronger and more complete mindfulness, then there arises more stronger and more complete wisdom. And this is through the process of energy. So the third one is energy. Once we have mindfulness developing wisdom, then all it is we put out more and more energy for the arising of more and more mindfulness and more wisdom. And here we have 11 things that lead to the arising of the enlightenment factor of energy. Number 1, reflection on the fearfulness of the states of woe, the states of loss. This means hell and the animal realms and being born as a ghost and so on. So it's sort of the fearsomeness of defilements. If our mind stays defiled like it is, we don't know where we're going when we die. None of us here sitting here has any clue when we're going to die. We can control when we log out of second life, but we can't control when we die in real life. Number 2, seeing the benefits of energy, seeing how useful it is to put out energy and to work hard at seeing the truth. Number 3, reflection on the path to be trodden, reflection on where we're going and thinking about what it is that we're doing and how great it is to be doing what we're doing. Number 4, the honoring of alms. Let me see what the commentary says about this one. We're probably just talking about how great it is to go on alms, because alms round can really give you a lot of energy. Anyway, I'm going to sort of assume that that's what it's meant here. Right, the honoring of alms, reflection on the greatness of the heritage. This is the heritage of a monk. When you think about how great it is to be a monk, which you know, I always like to do, I think it's pretty great being a monk, but this is kind of a monk thing. For lay people, you could think of how great it is to be, well, whatever it is you are. Not in terms of self, but in terms of how great it is to be in our position, to be able to practice and to be able to develop good things. And it's not conceit, it's sort of a way of awakening yourself and saying, hey, I better do something with it, or I can, you know, this is really going to be a wasted opportunity if I don't. Reflection on the greatness of the Buddha. When you think of how great he was and all the work he did, it kind of gives you a kick in the pants. Reflection on the greatness. Reflecting on the greatness of race. The greatness of race. I think I should have done my reading a little bit before that. Anyway, we're going to skip over that one. Probably, don't know. Reflection, this could be just I'll have to look that up later, but reflection on the greatness could just be for an ordinary person, when a person is a Brahmin or something. It's kind of a strange one. Reflection on the greatness of the fellows in the holy life. When you see your fellow meditators working hard, we're probably all aware of this one, where you see other people meditating, it really makes you feel guilty for being so lax, and it helps give us a push. Avoiding of lazy people. That's obvious. Associating with people who have begun effort, and the inclination towards the development of energy. Right, reflection on grace, on race means of being a son of or a daughter of the Buddha. Sakaya Tida, Sakaya Buddha. One who is a daughter or a son of the Buddha, being one of the lineage of the Buddha, and how great that is, and how hard an opportunity that is to find, and so working hard. Number four we call rapture. It's also translated as joy, I think, in this sutta. In this translation it's called joy. It doesn't exactly mean joy, but it means kind of sort of like a static charge that arises in the mind, where the mind is fully charged. Once you start developing effort and put out energy, then your mind gets this static charge, and it just becomes kind of like becomes second nature. The mindfulness becomes easier, and wisdom comes more frequent, and you're able to see things clearly. It kind of just becomes a habit. Meditation, people are, once you get into this, you're able to just walk and sit, walk and sit, walk and sit all day and all night with very little sleep, or sometimes even no sleep. Eleven things give rise to the factor of rapture. One, recollection on the Buddha. Two, recollection on the Dhamma. Three, recollection on the Sangha. Four, recollection on virtue. Five, these actually are the ten, almost, these are all of the meditation, reflection meditations. The Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, virtue, generosity, angels, peace. It's missing a couple, but all of these ones are helpful in developing this state of charged mind, and this state of mind which is charged and ready to go, or this state of mind which is fully enraptured with the meditation. But of course, it just simply comes from developing mindfulness as well. So these are only useful things. It's as auxiliary practices which we can undertake. So it's useful to think about the Buddha and his teachings, and but our morality, and this gives us confidence and so on. But once our mind becomes charged and focused, then there arises this calm, this state of peace. And this is the sixth one, or the fifth one, the calm, which is also called tranquility. Once we develop mindfulness again and again, and we're able to see clearer and clearer, then our minds become calm and focused. And become focused on the reality, not giving rise to liking or disliking. And it said that seven things lead to the arising of calm. Number one, having good food. So food is very useful for giving rise to calm. Again, these are all just auxiliary items. These are not the main item, which is the practice of meditation. Actually, meditation will give rise to these things, but there, you could also look at these as sort of dangers to our practice. If you have bad food, it can be difficult for there to give for a calm to arise. So sometimes you have to be careful about the things that you eat. Good weather, good posture. So appropriate posture. And sometimes sitting down is not so good, so you have to do lying or sitting down is no good, so you have to do standing or walking. As I said before, for people who are lazy, sometimes they should do walking. For people who are distracted, sometimes they should do lying, and so on. And judgment according to the middle way. So not pushing too hard and not being too lazy. Understanding which is the middle way, and not the way of torturing oneself or the way of indulging in sensuality. Indulging in pleasure. avoiding people who are restless, association with people who are physically calm and mentally calm, and the inclination towards the development of the enlightenment factor of calm or tranquility. Once the mind is calm, then there arises concentration. So the mind becomes totally fixed. And this is sort of all with mindfulness and wisdom going on in the background, because concentration, of course, is not, none of these are actually the goal, but this is how mindfulness and wisdom are developed and come to an increase. Because once we have tranquility, then of course we can give rise to more mindfulness. Once we have concentration, once we focus and the mind starts to really focus, then our wisdom becomes clearer and clearer. 11 things give rise to the factor of concentration. Purification of the bases, that's again having a good environment. Evenness to the spiritual controlling faculties, this is the 5 faculties. Skill in taking up the sign of the object of meditation. So sort of getting skilled at developing the meditation and catching the object in one's mind. Once we get better and better at it and we're able to see things as they are, because in the beginning things often slip through our awareness. So we see things and then it's very easy for us to fall into liking or disliking them. Sometimes emotions arise and we forget that they can also be observed as a meditation object. We can feel great states of happiness or liking, or we can have great states of depression or fear. Sometimes people have great fear in meditation and then so they stop meditating because they don't know how to deal with it. Sometimes people have great states of calm and they don't know how to deal with it. And so getting better at catching these things and seeing that they can also be used as a meditation object, this is, gives rise to concentration. This is sort of refining your meditation. Inciting the mind on the occasion, pushing the mind forward, I guess. Inciting the mind on occasion, restraining the mind on occasion, gladdening the mind on occasion, and regarding the mind without interfering on occasion. This is a very important passage. It's one that I haven't seen in a while. I was looking for it. This is very useful for a teacher, and it's very useful for a meditator. As a teacher, we have to sometimes incite the mind of the meditator. It means when they're lazy, we have to push them ahead. Sometimes they're going too far ahead and they're getting caught up in things which they shouldn't, so we have to restrain them. And the meditator has to do this themselves as well. Sometimes the mind is lazy, so we have to say, get up, do it, go for it. Sometimes the mind is chasing after things and we have to stop it and keep it from going out. Sometimes the mind is doubting and bored and so on, so we have to gladden it. We have to give rise to some kind of happiness or pleasure or peace. Maybe through chanting or through reflecting on the Buddha, as we've said before. And sometimes you have to regard the mind without interfering, and this is also true with meditation teachers. You know, sometimes you have to watch the student and not interfere. And you have to know when to interfere, when they're going too fast, when they're going too slow, when they're getting bored or discouraged. You have to encourage them. And sometimes you just have to be neutral towards them. And this is the case internally, and it's the case externally as a teacher. Avoiding people who are not collected in mind, association with people who are collected in mind, reflection on the absorptions and the emancipation. So this is reflection on fixed meditation states and on freedom from suffering, but this is only for enlightened beings. The sort of the state of enlightenment, reflection on the state of enlightenment, or reflection on absorption in the case of people who practice transcendental meditation. This develops more concentration. And finally, the inclination towards the development of concentration. And number 7 is equanimity. And 5 things lead to the arising of equanimity. Equanimity is the final step in meditation before the person becomes enlightened. When a person is able to see everything that comes into their field of awareness with equanimity, neither liking or disliking it, simply seeing it for what it is and being totally aware of it as it is, acknowledging it for what it is and nothing more. This is the final stage before the person enters into enlightenment, enters into nirvana. And five things lead to this. The detached attitude towards beings, so not getting caught up in concepts, in people and places and things, not getting caught up in objects, understanding things as experience instead of objects. Because when we get caught up in people, then of course there gives rise to all sorts of likings and dislikings. Detached attitude towards things, avoiding of persons who are egotistical in regard to living beings and things, people who have these views of self and soul, and people who are interested in you know, relationships and you know, getting caught up with this idea of a being or a self, people who are keen on ideas of self and soul and so on. Association with people who are neutral, impartial in regards to living beings and things, which means they don't attach any special importance on this being or that being, this thing or that thing. They see things and beings and everything around them as the same, as all worthy of love, of compassion, of joy and of equanimity, not being partial and not holding on to the idea of me and mine, us and them, and so on. So in this way, one gives rise to the seven factors of enlightenment. This is really the final teaching which we need, and once we have mastered sort of the practice of meditation, then we start looking at these seven things and whether they exist or do not, and try to develop them as best we can. The last section is the Four Noble Truths, and I think I'm going to just skip by that one, because I've given talks on this, and there are many talks on the Four Noble Truths. We'll just go quickly through it and say that the Four Noble Truths are this truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, which is our clinging to various things which could possibly make us suffer, and of course they make us suffer because we cling to them. The cessation of suffering, which is the cessation of clinging, and the path which leads to the cessation of suffering, which is basically the path which we're talking about in the rest of the sutta. So understanding these four is, after one becomes equanimous, then one understands the Four Noble Truths. One understands very clearly in one instant and understands the cessation, because it enters into the cessation through following the path. And the path is said technically only arises in one moment, or two or three thought moments or something like that, where just for that very short time we're able to see things clearly, and that's all it takes. Once we see that everything is a cause for suffering, when we cling to it, we stop clinging, and because of not clinging, then there's no suffering. And then the final section is the assurance of attainment, where the Buddha says, if anyone were to develop these four foundations of mindfulness for 7 years, then either they become an arahant, which is enlightenment, or they become an anagami, which means a non-returner. A non-returner is someone who, when they die, they're not reborn as a human or as an angel, but they're reborn in a immaterial state, which is something akin to a Brahma or a god, and they live in these pure abodes until they become free from suffering there. It's because there still is a desire for becoming, and so they do become again. And because of that desire, they enter into these pure abodes. They don't have any lust or greed or anger or so on, but there's still some defilements left, and then become enlightened there. And then he thinks about it again, and he says, you know, put aside 7 years. If you just do it for, and all, he goes all the way down to 7 days. If they were to do it perfectly well, even in 7 days, a person could become enlightened. And so he's basically saying to them that, you know, 7 years is sort of a good bet for most people, but really, if you were to put your heart into it, it wouldn't even take that long. that we can do this in a very short time. Most of us, it takes probably 7 years is still pushing it, but that's simply because we're not following the teaching exactly. And so following this teaching is of great benefit. And he said, because of this, it is said, this is the only way. Because you need to follow the practice of mindfulness in order to become free from suffering. We need to understand reality. There's no way to become free from suffering without understanding and experiencing things as they are. Thus spoke the Blessed One, satisfied, the bhikkhus approved of his words. So this is my explanation of the Satipatthana Sutta. Thank you all for coming. And if you have any questions, happy to take them. Otherwise, see you next time. It's a bit concerned about the bit of avoiding people. Oh yeah. How can you help people when you're not enlightened? Okay, thanks Zeno for coming. What are you going to help them do? Okay, thanks for coming everyone. I mean, the key here is that we're like a river. Everything that we do is like a river pouring out. And if the water is not pure, then you can say the river is giving water to all the beings down the way. But if the water is impure, then there's no benefit that can come from it. So when we're trying to become enlightened, it's imperative that we first of all avoid these people for our own benefit. Once we become enlightened, then for sure we don't have to avoid anyone. But this is a teaching for those on the path. And I mean, on the other hand, it doesn't mean we have to avoid in terms of not helping people, to an extent. But it's kind of like, you know, give them what they need and try to stay away from them as much as possible, because there's not much you can do to help these people. Yeah, once you become enlightened, there's no need to avoid anyone. This is a practical teaching. And as you get further along the path, it gets less important. But, sometimes the best thing you can do for someone is to avoid them. Or not exactly avoid them, but, yeah, sort of avoid them or not give them too much attention. Because obviously, if someone's on the wrong path, the more attention you give them, it's like the more encouragement you give them to do the wrong things. And by the same token, as you try to help them and convince them not to follow those bad deeds, if you're not enlightened, it just leads to fighting and so on. You mean avoided people? It's skillfulness in avoiding people, trying to find time to be on your own without making people feel bad. That's the reason why we avoid these people, is because they're clingy and they're really hard to get away from. It doesn't mean you have to say, look, I don't want to be around you anymore, or something like that. But, you know, try your best to avoid these situations where you have to say that. Like, excuse me, it's been 3 hours now and I really should go meditate or so on. I feel I have no closure. Well, you have to understand that that is generally because of the clinging and the craving that we have towards that person. There really is no closure. There is no being. There is only the experience and the memories which you have. You have no closure because of still an attachment to this person, or the idea of the person. Yeah, I mean, the key here is changing the way we look at reality from us and them, me and him and so on, to just being experience. And it's sort of also the impartiality towards beings, where we don't look at one person as special, because it's really kind of ridiculous. Everyone is special, and, or you could look at it in that way as well, that every being should be treated as equally special. I think it does away with relationships, yes. I guess I'd have to say I have this, my view is that relationships are ridiculous. I suppose there's, you know, the functional relationships where you're helping each other, where you're supporting each other, where you go and find people who have the same goals. But you're doing it for your own benefit and a mutual benefit. You're saying, if I go near these people, I'll be able to develop. And they think the same, if I go near this person, then I'll be able to develop, and we do it for ourselves. But as for who we give to and who we love and who we appreciate, I think that should be everybody. I don't think we should ever make any distinction between beings. I always say, whoever's, and this is a common thing for Buddhist monks. There was one famous Buddhist monk in my tradition. He said, he asked, who's the most important person in the world? And the audience gave all these different answers, and he said, no, the answer is whatever person is with you at that time. Whoever you're with, that's the most important person. I would happy to be done with relationships. Well, you could always become a monk or a nun. Sorry, I'm missing some questions here. I'm not looking at the computer. I guess I got them. You could only be a monk. I don't know. You don't think it's possible for a ordinary person to not have special people in their life? To see everyone equally? To see everyone as sort of special in their own way, or worthy of one's equal love and appreciation? Yeah, but I mean, monks have problems with clinging as well. I suppose less, but I mean, that's the problem, of course. The problem is clinging. Right. No, but I do know people who live in the world and don't have any close affections. They live as hermits, or they live in an apartment as on their own. I guess it'd be difficult if you got married and had kids to really get in that position. Although I do know people who do that as well, and kind of feel themselves apart from their own family, like they're just doing their job. But I don't know. I don't really understand. I don't have a wife and I don't have kids, so I'm probably not the one to talk about that. I can imagine how difficult it would be. I hope it's possible for an ordinary person. Ah, you don't want to become a monk? You're already bald. Good for you. But there's no need to become a monk. I think it is possible for, in fact, there are cases of where ordinary people have been able to do this. Becoming a monk is just a tool. It's, if you have the opportunity, it's a great way to accelerate your practice. But it is what you make of it. If you become a monk, you could also be lazy. It's not to say that you're just I'm going to suddenly do away with all of these things when you become a monk. I have two young boys who really miss their daddy. I wish I knew how to comfort them. Well, you have to, explaining to them, helping them to understand these things, understand reality, having them meditate and watching their feelings. I mean, there's no need to talk about daddy. Just talking about your own feelings, the feelings that we have. And it's not like just a talking thing, but it's having to do with meditation practice, like sitting in meditation and telling them we're just going to watch. I'd like to put together a video on how to teach children meditation, because I have had some success in teaching children lately. Here in Los Angeles, I've been invited for the first time to teach children, and it's quite an interesting experience. There are ways of getting them at least to focus their mind. You don't have to address the issue itself. You just have to give them some tools and then start telling them of the various things that could arise and how to deal with those things as well, and let them do the rest. You don't need to go in poking and prodding. This isn't the way to teach. We don't need to delve or to sort of try to bring out things that they are repressing. That's really a dead end. That's not the way to teach. You give them the tools, the way to focus and to look at their minds, and it'll all come out by itself, especially as they grow up. Try to make it okay in your mind, and let them see that you're not affected by it, and they'll take your example. I don't think you have to ask how young. I think you just have to adapt it based on how young they are. Oh, you're asking her. 3 and 10. 3 is tough, obviously, but again, the example that you set is going to be a big part of it. And then just talking to them about the various tools that we have for meditation, how to fix and focus and watch. Yeah, 10 I think is good to. You could give them some pretty concrete tools. At 3, there's probably not much concrete you could give them. It's probably just more talking to them and helping them to see that it's not a big deal. Because remember, this is all delusion. This idea of people and special people and important people. I mean, it's obviously nice to have a father, and being without one is kind of, you're at a bit of a disadvantage functionally, but I mean, it seems like it's probably more just an emotional need, which is something that we cultivate ourselves, and it doesn't have to exist. We've got each other, we've got who we have, and if, as long as we're able to support each other on a functional basis, then just living with what we have should be enough. It's just kind of a delusion that persists in the mind, this idea of special people. Or this clinging to special people. So having them see that it's not such a big deal, that people go on, explaining about death and how it comes to us all, and one day we're all going to die, and that's just the way it is. Yeah, it's really, what the amazing thing is that the only reason we're suffering is because we don't understand things. There's nothing making us suffering. There's nothing in the world that can make us suffer. There's nothing bad in the whole world. There's no experience which is negative. For sure. It's sometimes amazing as a monk, I suppose, to see how strong people's clinging is. Although even as a monk we can give rise to it. It's easy to cling to people. But it's all just illusion. It's all just something going on in our minds. The person only exists in our minds. They look at me. Well, you don't have to tell them what happens after death. You just have to explain to them that it comes to all of us. And you can explain to them the different ideas that many people, especially, you know, they say Buddhists, in Buddhism they say that, you know, when you die then the mind keeps going, the mind keeps moving on. And so in that sense their father might still be around somewhere and one day we'll meet him again. And just explain to them it's part of life. You can have them go through the logic in their mind that one day they're going to die, one day their mother's going to die. You know, this is reality. And in fact, it's probably a good thing for them to have gone through this, because they're not going to be negligent and live their lives thinking that all is okay and there's nothing that needs to be done and we can just go out and have fun because mom and dad are going to live forever or so on. And it's good to have this wake-up call. So just explaining to them that this is the way of it. I mean, dad, their father has left this life, but he might have been born already, and they might meet him as a friend. I mean, it's funny how this kind of goes totally against the way we look at things in the Western world. At least the idea of what we can be certain of, that everyone has to die. The old, the young, the middle in years, the fool, and eke the wise. For rich or poor, one end is sure, each one among them dies. Well, you're welcome. I hope I'll be able to find some more good things to bring up. This sutta is really good. I think in some ways going through it like this is a little bit of overkill. In fact, normally when I teach this sutta, I would normally boil it all down to, you know, a 5-minute talk and then send you off to meditate. because basically that's all it is see it for yourself and really work on the clinging and working on the misunderstandings.